Welcome to our first ever Opinio Juris podcast. So this is Peter Spiro. I teach law at Temple University, and I'm a permanent contributor to the blog. And I'm joined by three fellow contributors. We have Peggy McGinnis, who teaches law at St. John's University. Hello, Peggy.
Hi.
We have Duncan Hollis, my colleague at Temple. Hello, Duncan.
Hello, hello.
And Julian Koo, who teaches law at Hofstra University, my former colleague at Hofstra. And so we're here to discuss this week's arguments in the big Supreme Court case in Bond versus United States, the big treaty power case. So what we thought we'd do today in this discussion is take a little bit of a look at how the case got to the Supreme Court, then discuss the arguments on Tuesday and where they might point for purposes of a decision in the case, and then think through some of the implications of the Supreme Court's disposition of the case. So it's not a typical set of facts for a foreign relations law case. The thing that sort of has struck me all the way through, or I guess bothered me about it, is that it really shouldn't have been a case at all. So we have a woman who uses a sort of over-the-counter chemical to assault her husband's lover, and it's really a pretty small-time crime, and yet it becomes the test case for the treaty power. And we haven't had a test case for the treaty power since the Supreme Court's decision in Missouri versus Holland in 1920. And so I was thinking a little bit about why it bugged me so much, and I think one way of working through it is that it offends my State Department sensibilities, insofar as if they'd gone to the State Department and said, we want to prosecute this person under the chemical weapons treaty, everybody at the state, I think, would have flashed the red lights. And yet, because this kind of decision is made at the level of local federal prosecutor, the case went ahead. I don't know if others have any thoughts of that.
I actually think it's not a silly case. This woman was a microbiologist, right? This isn't her using the bleach from her laundry room or just some stuff that was under this thing. She took some pretty heavy-duty arsenic-based chemical from her workplace, and then she ordered some other stuff over the internet. She had some knowledge of, you know, what these chemicals could do when brought into contact with human beings, including this woman and her young child. And, you know, thinking about, we could talk about the oral argument, I guess, in a few minutes, but thinking about how the oral argument proceeded, you know, I really felt strongly that the government has a pretty strong case that it would be really unfortunate if the court defines sort of where the line is on this sort of dual use problem out there in the world when we're talking about, you know, serious arms control, serious chemical weapons control, and this problem of dual use. I don't think you have to be, you know, a licensed member of Al-Qaeda to be someone who's in a gray zone where, you know, the government wants to go after you for violations of the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Any thoughts on that, you guys? I mean, we could get into the arguments themselves, because I think this figured pretty prominently in some of the questions from the conservative side of the bench, and I think sort of rightly so. So I disagree in this sense that, I mean, at the same time that one wouldn't want to trivialize what Carol Ann Bond did, I mean, you know, it's pretty serious assault and something that she should be punished for. I think what makes this case seem trivial is that it really is of no international consequence. It's of no international consequence. I mean, nobody's arguing that other countries care about this particular case.
No, but this argument that international means other countries care. We care deeply, for example, of the use of chemical weapons that's completely contained within the territory of Syria. So I think that the fact that it's purely, quote-unquote, local is not...
No, but But that's not, this is not a, and, you know, Sotomayor tried to play the Syria card early on, and it just wouldn't stick because this, obviously the use of chemical weapons in Syria is of international consequence. Other countries care about it a lot. Nobody cares about this use of chemical weapons. And that just puts the government, I think, totally on its heels in terms of defending why is it that that state police power should be invaded here? Well, if it's something where, just as Roberts pointed out, we've got no amicus briefs as we usually do these days from other countries saying how much they care about a particular issue.
So one question, though, there, Peter, is whether other countries are a little asleep at the wheel, because I certainly think they're going to care, and I know we'll talk about this more later, they're going to care if the court significantly curtails the U.S. treaty power and the dynamic of U.S. treaty negotiations in the future changes to, nope, we can't negotiate that because we're not sure we can bring it home domestically. So, you know, I think there's probably some middle ground here. I think on the facts, it's been just interesting to me to see, you know, this real effort at framing on both sides, with one side, you know, emphasizing, well, you know, is it really the case that everybody's thinking this is funny because the child doesn't die? You know, if the child had died, wouldn't we be looking at this case in a dramatically different way? And then I think on the other side, you know, the folks, you know, kind of emphasizing, as you did, that, you know, these are dual-use chemicals. They're not the same as sarin gas and the like. And I think those folks seem to be winning the public relations battle, obviously. But, you know, I don't know, as between the two, we can definitively say who's right and who's wrong.
I think part of the problem, just to add one more thing on this point, is that I think what's bugging people, what's making this look like, for the conservatives, a regular federalism case, is that this is something easily prosecuted under state law, right? So this is what makes it look like they're overreaching. It's not like they had to go to the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act because they couldn't possibly prosecute her in any other way. So that's why I think one of the things that's resonating with the court's federalism folks is that this is a classic case of federal overreaching, because it's something that, given the nature, the local nature of what was going on, except for the actual item use, which itself was dual use, everything else about this case looks like a plain vanilla state domestic dispute.
Yeah, and I actually agree with that, Julian, but I also think that explains, Duncan, a little bit why we're not hearing from the rest of the international community, right? I mean, this isn't – they sort of want to respect, I would think. There's a certain degree of prosecutorial discretion going on here. But the question is really not, you know, was it necessary for this particular prosecution – but whether it's certainly within the discretion of federal prosecutors given the text of the implementing statute. And I think it's there where the international community, I would imagine, would not want to weigh in one way or the other, because everyone wants to preserve some flexibility to permit these kinds of prosecutions, because there will be cases that are somewhere between the hardened al-Qaeda member who's looking to detonate, you know, a chemical weapon with serious numbers of casualties, and sort of, you know, the teenager who's fooling around with radical politics, who, you know, takes it to school. So there is some space here, I think, to find this a proper prosecution. But I totally get that point, that on the facts, it just it raises the sort of police powers question.
And it's also, as Roberts pointed out in the argument, it's a contrast to a lot of other foreign relations law cases where you do have other countries clearly upset about whatever's being, or, you know, upset if the federal government weren't to have the power. Medellin's is the obvious contrast, I guess, where the court, by finding a treaty non-self-executing, was doing something that actually directly complicated foreign relations.
Right. Well, this is the thing that's interesting about the penal nature of this and the prosecutorial discretion. And this comes up, you know, in the human rights context all the time, right? I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which states are going to come to the convention and comply. So that's how I view this sort of, you know, radio silence from the rest of the world, is there's a shrug, like, okay, you can do this, you know, you can prosecute this way or not prosecute this way. We're pretty sure that you're complying with the convention obligations either way. It could be state versus federal. We're pretty indifferent as to that. Whereas in the BCCR cases, that's, you know, those are clear, direct obligations that weren't met.
So how do people think that the arguments went?
I was a little surprised. I mean, you know, again, you don't want to overread into these transcripts. So I mean, remember the healthcare law argument, right? But I think that there's it's not a good sign when Justice Breyer is pushing the government to come up with a narrowing interpretation of the statute. It's not necessarily mean that he's going to go that way, but that he brought it up at least twice and maybe in my count three times, and he is a sign that he finds that in very something he wants to explore. And since and the other bad sign for the government was that the conservative justices seem to see this as a purely federalism case rather than a foreign relations case. And if they frame it in that, if they see it in that framework, at least Scalia made a couple of comments at least twice where he kept talking about that as a federalism case. I think that's also a problem for the government, because if the five justices who tend to be in favor of a very robust federalism see it as a federalism case, not any other kind of case, then that's not a good sign. So that's why I've been, my own take on it was that this is both the Breyer's comments and Kagan's to lesser comments, and then plus the framing of this as a federalism case is a real problem for the government.
I don't think the government did itself any favors. You know, they obviously kind of come in with a pretty fixed approach to how they were going to defend this case, and you've got Breyer there saying, give me a line, give me a line. Just tell me, you know, what, if any, you know, what's the structural limitation, where does the line go? And the Solicitor General just would not give an answer. And I kind of understand why going in you'd want to resist that position, but when it becomes so clear that, you know, when they start talking about, you know, are we going to prosecute for feeding chocolate to dogs, and, you know, in some ways making the case that, you know, fanciful, and he still won't bite, you know, it definitely looked like the government got bloodied in the argument a bit to me.
I thought that was the most important exchange, and it was interesting because I hadn't thought about why it was so, you know, why Verrilli took such a strong line. And it really got me thinking about the problem of interpretation of dual use. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense for the government to hold a very strict line here. You do not want the court saying, for example, that giving chocolate, you know, to people who would be subject to illness or death if they took chocolate would not necessarily fit within the convention definitions, because this is about using chemicals to cause harm. And it's not just in the context of war. It's very clear from the history of the Chemical Weapons Convention that it was moving beyond any kind of international definitions of war, or maybe even a non-international armed conflict, to include other harmful effects that, you know, are in this gray zone of criminal law and maybe something more than criminal law, like terrorism. And so I, you know, I felt so bad for him in that exchange, but how can you, what line should the government draw here on this statute?
Well, just draw any line. I mean, one, the interesting contrast was to Verrilli's response on the sarin hypothetical.
Verrilli's response?
When,
Clement got that too. Clement got that sarin.
Sorry, Clement's response when
right.
He conceded that if she'd been using sarin, you know, then it qualifies for the for prosecution under this law, even though he doesn't really have a particularly principled way of doing it. I guess sarin's on some scheduled list where
right.
The chemicals involved in the Bond case weren't.
Right. No, I was going to say I thought that was interesting, but it was in the, you know, sarin's listed in the annex and is not considered a dual use. But I thought the more interesting, really brief exchange was with Sotomayor when she said, so if a terrorist had put this on doorknobs in Boston or something to that effect, and Clement said, oh, yeah, that would be covered. So, I mean, that's a problem, I think, for the petitioner's side. You know, the fact that she's in, you know, a vengeful a woman whose husband's had an affair instead of a politically committed terrorist isn't a distinction that this statute or this convention makes in terms of the intent.
Yeah, and my own sense is this is, you know, you clearly saw the court wrestling with the two ways the treaty is set up. And as you said, Peggy, it's really set up about use, right? There's chemical weapons broadly defined and use is broadly defined. And the courts seem to have trouble, I think, with both being broadly defined. So in some ways, that line drawing that Breyer and others were seeking was, you know, we'll draw a line around one. Can you draw a line around the chemicals, like just the chemicals listed in the annex? Answer, no. Well, what about a line around the use, kind of the distinction between the vengeful spouse and the, you know, the terrorists spreading it on doorknobs in Boston? Again, no. And I think that what you were seeing yesterday was a resistance to the idea that of not drawing any lines under either. And so, you know, I was kind of interested in some of the commentary of how some have suggested some sort of two-step. You know, if it's a prohibited chemical that's listed in the convention, maybe we interpret the statute to be any use. But if it's, you know, other chemicals, you know, you might want to come up with a more robust definition of what peaceful purposes are, or something that you know, gives more of a zone of autonomy to, you know, state criminal law or, in this case, prosecution.
So, Duncan, you think that's a line the court should draw or Congress should draw?
Ultimately, I think that it's a line Congress should draw, but I got the clear sense yesterday that that the court, or 2 days ago, that the court was really troubled by, you know, that the treaty negotiators were obviously trying to come up with a comprehensive ban on chemical weapons and had swung the pendulum so far. And from the court's perspective, it seems they think it's too far. So in some ways, although everybody kept saying this was a valid treaty and they weren't contesting that it, you know, reaches Syria and elsewhere, I think part of the subtext was unless you find distance between the treaty and the implementing legislation, the subtext was the treaty might be reaching too far. And you saw some hints of that in the argument, which the Solicitor General kind of ran away from when asked to, you know, justify the, you know, why this was a valid exercise of the treaty power in all cases as applied.
So coming out of the argument, where do we think the court might end up? Is it, are there limiting constructions that are possible? Is Missouri versus Holland sort of, is there a serious prospect that it's just going to be overruled? What do we think the most likely result here is, and what are the implications of what the court does? Julian, do you think that the court's going to overrule Missouri versus Holland?
don't get me excited. I doubt it. I guess I'm guessing what we get is what I think Clement and what Justice Breyer pushed the government to think about is the narrowing construction of peaceful, and to interpret peaceful. I can see that there might be some pushback on this, but there's at least, to me, a fairly high likelihood that they invoke the narrowing construction, and they might say we adopt this to avoid constitutional conflict that might exist between a broad interpretation of this treaty and principles of federalism. So they don't have to go out and overrule Missouri v. Holland, but they can sort of fire a warning shot across the bow of the government and say respect federalism even for treaties, which I think is what they want. And then you might get a concurrence, maybe from Scalia, who might adopt wholesale a stricter view. I'm not sure, again, if it was a way, you know, remember, they're not arguing about Missouri v. Holland in the classic sense. I mean, I think they're arguing about the one sentence in Missouri v. Holland, the implemented statute. I mean, that's really what seems to be attractive. It's kind of an odd argument, but it seems to have attracted a lot of support in the court. And I can imagine concurrence which adopts that view. I just don't think that gets five votes. And so I imagine.
So this is the Nick Rosencrantz two-step argument, that it's the problem is with the implementing legislation and not with the treaty itself. And so, and Julian, do you buy that argument?
I don't buy it completely as an original matter, and I have some issues with it textually. But I don't think it's necessarily wrong. I think it definitely was something that was thrown in there and has never really been analyzed very carefully. Interestingly, they didn't exactly argue about that in this case. I can imagine the getting into it. And then they didn't, I think the problem with that argument is, why would it make sense to have a treaty could do something, but that a statute implementing the treaty couldn't do. And they, in the argument, they just said, well, it doesn't matter because they're exactly the same. But at least twice, Scalia said, no, they're not, and it's different to have a treaty versus a statute doing this, and that makes a big difference to me. So it seems like there's going to be some interest in that. I do think it's an interesting argument from a strategic point of view. I'm not sure it's right as an original matter. But then again, I was struck by that argument because it was something that is the part of Missouri that no one paid attention to, right? And it would be, even if they adopted that argument, five votes, it's a relatively, it doesn't therefore overrule what Missouri v. Holland is typically known for, which is for a very broad reading of the treaty power unconstrained by the 10th Amendment. That part would still be there. It would just be the statute. An implementing statute would have to be much more narrow. So I can see that. I can see the argument attracting a couple votes. I'm not sure it's at five.
You know, Jean Galbraith's piece gets into the history of the late sort of 19th, early 20th century understandings of that. And I think in a rather convincing way, at least to show that as of 1920, this, setting aside what this court will do with Missouri, but Missouri v. Holland, but saying, you know, no one immediately after the founding or throughout the 19th century, early 20th century, thought that the Rosencrantzian sort of slicing of the clause made was applicable, and that there were many instances where Congress is exceeding, you know, it's Article 1, Section 8 powers in passing implementing legislation, and in fact, Congress and the court seem pretty clear that. There seemed to be some consensus that was right even before the issue was squarely met in Missouri v. Holland. I throw that out for what it's worth. I'm not big on, you know, the salience of history per se, but it's an interesting backstory.
Duncan, what's your prediction?
So I think I probably align with Julian. If I had to guess, my sense is that this case is going to be resolved on the statutory interpretation ground. I guess I was struck to continue the theme of how much the justices seem to accept. Now, maybe it was just for purposes of the argument, but I was surprised at seeing folks like, I think it was Scalia, you know, accepting the idea that a self-executing treaty could do whatever it wanted, you know, or at least shy of violating an explicit constitutional prohibition, you know, and so, you know, there is this irony that if the court does somehow get to five votes on the one sentence, Missouri v. Holland, it somehow is going to preserve this new world where if the President and the Senate want to, they can go beyond Congress's powers through a self-executing treaty. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, I think that's very, you know, going to be very pragmatically difficult. It's hard enough these days to get the Senate to agree to anything. But, if I had to guess, it seemed to me what the court was most concerned about here was federalism. They were concerned about what Congress does vis-a-vis the states, and in some ways less concerned about what, you know, the United States does outside the country. And, you know, there was at least a couple of nods, oh, no, we don't want to implicate anything going on in Syria. And so I think that, you know, the path to doing that is to basically chop back at any reading of the statute that would have implicated the states, because you can do it without actually triggering a treaty compliance question.
Right. So I think I also agree that they'll try to split the difference with some sort of narrowing construction, or by setting up some sort of hurdle to applying a treaty that invades traditional state prerogatives. So two interesting suggestions, one from David Golov on the Just Security blog. David suggests that they might apply some sort of clear statement requirement to a treaty where it would otherwise invade traditional state authorities, so that it would have to be clear under the treaty that that's what was intended. Obviously, this wouldn't qualify under that test. And then Mike Ramsey has a test that's a little bit more difficult to apply and would tend to favor state power a little more in the balance, and that is that there be some sort of showing of necessity by way of the exercise of federal enforcement powers under a treaty, so that it would have to be, and that, again, this case obviously would fail under that test to the extent that state authorities are perfectly capable of undertaking compliance with the treaty on their own. So those are sort of two interesting possibilities beyond just a straight statutory construction move. I mean, I think the court, if it wants to get there, it can get there however it wants to. One possible break here would be with three or four of the conservative justices looking for a more advocating a more frontal attack on Missouri, and then Kennedy being the concurring fifth with something that's more with something that's narrower.
I'm not going to make any predictions on this one, but I do think it's interesting. I think it was Duncan mentioned, or someone mentioned the Scalia and non-self-executional. All I could think was, what about Medellin? So, you know, we've got a court that is quite effectively put its stake in the ground in terms of it will say what's self-executing, what's not self-executing. So to the extent that they take any moves that further curb the treaty power, this is a pretty significant move, you know, in terms of a two-step here between Medellin and this case. So my preference would be for not getting to that broader question of the scope, and if you guys are right that it's a narrowing, I think that that's a huge loss for the Chemical Weapons Convention, but maybe there are statutory fixes that can be done after Ms. Bond's case is resolved.
So how important does the case end up being? Assume that you've got some narrowing of Missouri's pretty expansive conception of the treaty power. Is it a big case? Is it in terms of actually?
You ask me whether it's a big case if it goes to the scope of the treaty power. I mean, anything that I think that. That narrows Missouri v. Holland is a big case. On the other hand, Peter, I you know, in reference to your own writings on this, and it came up in oral argument in terms of, you know, the Senate's already there is a pretty good check for the states on treaty approvals. And, you know, if Missouri v. Holland was the case that gave the national government, you know, to use a Spinal Tap reference, 11 on the scale of national power, you know, the State Department's only turned it up to about 2. So all of these concerns of, you know, Chief Justice Roberts mentioned, you know, adopting treaties that, you know, require the government to, you know, replace the states in terms of implementing powers and so on, these are all sort of fantastical and theoretical. So I think from that perspective, we're unlikely to see a narrowing of the scope. But it is interesting to think that Missouri v. Holland has never been used in the way that the Commerce Clause power has been used.
I would add, you know, what's interesting to me about this in terms of its impacts is, again, I think Missouri v. Holland is more rhetorical. I actually recall when I was at the State Department and in a treaty negotiation and had another government cite Missouri v. Holland back at me when I was adopting a negotiating position of why the U.S. didn't want to agree to a particular provision. And, you know, so I think one of the things that could come out of this case and what might make it big is it's going to change that negotiating landscape. Not that the U.S. is actually, you know, relying on Missouri v. Holland very much, but it's certainly negotiating with an eye to Missouri v. Holland and an eye to federalism. You know, my sense is that the U.S. does not ignore states' rights. It actually tries to negotiate around these issues sometimes. Sometimes it tries to carve out specific exceptions or, you know, certainly the package of RUDs, reservations and understandings and declarations adjust to it. So I do think that there could be some pretty symbolic importance to this case in the sense of how the U.S. is able to go around and negotiate in the future when other states are going to now be on notice that between this and Medellin, it's not really clear that the U.S. is going to be able to, you know, match its words in reality, going forward in terms of treaty compliance.
Julian? I guess I have two takes to this. One, and this is slightly different. I'm not sure. I guess Ms. Duncan, you were actually there, negotiating, so I don't know. But I would be surprised if it had a huge impact. I guess there are other countries that have similar federal issues when they negotiate, and I think, you know, the U.S., if for whatever reason this case stood for the proposition that the federal government has limited powers to implement treaties, you know, through the power that Peter points out they never seem to use anyways. I just doubt that would have a huge impact. And I think the evidence, I think I agree with Duncan here, is that the U.S. government already spends their time worrying about federalism, and this would only bolster to some degree their point, because then people would not be able to cite Missouri v. Holland toward them, at them. I mean, the other thing I would say, just in the larger scheme, I think if you take a step back and you look at this court between Medellin, Kiobel, and then if Bond goes, say, the more aggressive Bond to cut back directly on Missouri, those would be three pretty significant cases, a real shift or turn in foreign relations law in different levels. In Medellin, the combination of Medellin and say, a strong federalism version of Bond, I don't know that it would have a huge impact on practice, but it would really cause foreign relations scholars and lawyers to rethink the landscape a little bit, right? The treaties, non-self-executing treaties are something the principles of Medellin stood for requiring a rigorous understanding of a treaty before it's interpreted as self-executing, and then a robust understanding of federalism that it really does have a judicially enforceable constraint on the implementation of the treaty power. These are pretty significant from a doctrinal perspective, even if they don't have a huge practical impact. I'm a little skeptical of the practical impact because many of our treaties are already non-self-executing, whether or not the court works their way to interpret it that way. And very few of our treaties, and I agree with Duncan and Peter, are really directly aimed at federalism. All this would do is, I think, provide the doctrinal basis to make sure the political branches don't go there.
Yeah, so I think I agree pretty much completely with Julian. The federal government has really made no use of Missouri versus Holland. And this might, if the court scales back Missouri versus Holland, it might be sort of embarrassing for federal negotiators in their in treaty negotiations, because they look it's sort of outing them almost. It's making transparent constraints that have already been pretty consistently applied on the ground, so that the federal government's always been super sensitive to any federalism concerns. Just as an aside, there was the disability convention hearings on the Hill also on Tuesday, and those sensitivities were really apparent in those hearings as well. And I think Julian's second point is also a really interesting one, that maybe the most important thing that would come out of this decision is that it's consistent with the courts pushing back in foreign relations in a way that it really hasn't done for a long time. So Medellin and then the Jerusalem passport case, I don't think the court's scared of foreign relations anymore. And that could have broader implications. That could have more concrete implications in some other areas, to the extent
I would say
no longer defer to the political branches in the area.
Yeah, and I mean, I was going to say Julian framed it really nicely, and one thing that I would say that is a common thread running through almost all of these cases is this sort of irrational, in my view, fear of the international human rights system, a system that the United States has very carefully, stayed at the very margins of. But, the federalism, the federalism arguments may come back to bite some of the conservatives on these questions of, U.S. courts as destinations for international litigation, because I think the story is yet to be written, and we may see some activism at the state level, which may make things a little bit more complicated for those who they might be wishing for the pre-Kiobel days 10 years from now. But we'll see. We'll see how it develops. But I do think there's a lot of action is now moving to the states.
So I would add just to that, Peter, I agree with you that I think we're seeing the court no longer afraid to deal with foreign relations. But one thing I would say, and you saw it in Medellin and you saw it yesterday, is that if they're going to engage with foreign relations, they or their clerks need to do a bit more work. I mean, part of the problem is that they're getting basic facts wrong on silly little stuff. And that's one thing that just worried me in some ways, is that, like, we're having a fairly sophisticated discussion, and what does a non-self-executing treaty mean, and, how do you interpret, what a treaty means for purposes of implementing legislation. But, these we're seeing people don't understand, the two-step treaty signature versus ratification. They don't understand, they misstate who's ratifying the treaty. And so in some ways, one hopes that if they're going to make this move to get bent into foreign relations, they'll do a little bit more education to make sure that they at least have the basics right.
Well, that means we'll be fully employed, Duncan.
Well, it means they have to get clerks who've taken international law. So, any final thoughts?
This was fun.
So, thanks very much to all of you, and we'll look forward to doing this again in the future.
I think we should reconvene this particular podcast when the decision comes out.
Okay.
Sounds great.
Okay, that's a deal.
All right.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thanks, everyone.
Good night.